It's so nice to see people from historic church background who are actually interested in church planting. I can't tell you what a thrill it is. There are times that some of us feel like Elijah alone in the caves thinking, they're all gone. I'm the last unicorn to mix our metaphors. But evidently there are 500 whom the prophets of Baal have not touched. So, good morning. My name is Connie and I'm a recovering church planter. And it would be so helpful for me to find out who is here. How many of you are in parish ministry right now? And how many with some responsibility for evangelism, outreach, church planting, or whatever, development? Okay. How many are technically not responsible but doing it anyways? Church planters. It's not compulsive behavior, but it's similar. How many of you have judiciary responsibility or supervisory responsibility for the area of development, church planting? How many of you have actually been part of a church plant? How many of you would if you had the opportunity? How many of you would if it put you in a position of professional insecurity and questionable income? Oh, dear. You may get that opportunity yet. I have to tell you, I get the worst case of butterflies before I come to these things because I feel like I hold the Sons of Sceva chair of theology. And you know the story from the book of Acts, the parallels break down in some places, but there's a sense when we go to conferences, we have experts in various fields. And I have an internal mechanism that reminds me of the Sons of Sceva who used the name of Jesus whom Paul preached. And the not particularly receptive audience said, "We know this Jesus and we know Paul. But who the heck are you?" And most of us who have done church planting or contemplate church planting don't fit into the regular categories because the regular categories don't plant churches anymore. And so, in a sense, we operate out of three realms. There is an academic and theological overarching understanding, which we heard expanded brilliantly last night, and I will thank George several times for the trellis on which to hang our church plants, because without sound DNA, it is possible to plant a beast of a church, but more often we plant these sickly little things that depend on denominational support forever and ever and ever, and simply suck the parents dry. And if you've ever seen an adult robin running mama and papa robin ragged, literally demanding worms when the big clunking thing is big enough to go hunt for itself. That's what many of our church plants become because of poor DNA. I was taught in church planting, and I'm 70% in favor of it, that if your church plant is not financially self-supporting within 2 years, it may never be. I would expand that to five, but I'd say you'd better be 50% by 2 years, or you're just not heading there. And a wise denominational support. By the way, none of this applies if I plant again. But a wise denominational structure will make sure that a church either does or dies, because if it doesn't have the will to live, then it will depend. It will be dependent forever, not unlike 30-somethings who are living in basements. We won't go there. Okay. Before we go any further, it would also be helpful to me if I know many of you are Anglicans and therefore possible introverts. But can any of you tell me what you're really hoping to get out of this conference? Just shout it out or whisper it out, or I don't know the liturgical introduction for it, so just what would you really like to leave here having got? A job, okay. Yes. I'll email your bishop immediately. Yes, what else? Re-energized, in what sense? Yes. Good. If I don't get there by tomorrow morning, do put your hand up and remind me, because there are brutal stages of church planting that if the judiciary does not understand, we'll get ground into the ground before we finish. Right? What else? Encouragement for your planting. Not, you have planted? You plan to plant? Maybe. Yeah, okay. That's fine. That wasn't a test of character. Anything else? Interestingly enough, one of the marks of a church planter is extraordinary resilience, or perhaps short memory. Because if you are a personality type who has to do it right every time the first time, it will make you crazy, because what worked last week will not work this week. I saw a great cartoon. The bottom said, second week of a church plant, and a guy is sitting in a chair next to a musician said, but that's not the way we've always done it. And I can tell you what worked for church planting 20 years ago did not work 10 years ago and would not work today. And something else will work today, because this is a God-ordained mandate. I think that church planting actually, I mean, it not only comes out of the Great Commission, but it's rooted somewhere in our doctrine of creation, where God says, be fruitful and multiply. Now, those of us who have teenagers are always constantly aware of the possibility of unwanted multiplication. Most of the world, for most of history, has succeeded in multiplying. I'm not saying every individual, but populations do multiply spontaneously, naturally, continuously, so long as there's something to feed them and a place to live, they do it. Churches, without, it's going to be hard to believe, but without seminars, have managed to reproduce for millennia. And yet around the corner from where I live are suddenly popping up new franchises, their fertility clinics. And I talked to a very sad woman 3 weeks ago who had spent $40,000 trying to have a baby, unsuccessfully, with methods that were intrusive and nasty and intruding in every aspect of her life. And I thought, where's the irony here? And so the one of the presumptions that I'm going on in terms of church planting is that not every congregation is going to plant, and not every grouping of churches perhaps will plant, but generally speaking, there is a mechanism which God has placed in all living thing that they will reproduce unless we artificially do something to stop them. And so then the question becomes not how do we make it happen, but how do we stop stopping it from happening? Follow that? And so I'm thinking in terms of three things, and one is there is an overarching theology, and the DNA is very, very important. I believe deeply, personally, experientially, that many of the ailments that undermine church plants are, in fact, inappropriate living our relationship with the entire Trinity. And there was one thing last night that had never occurred to me before, that the Trinity itself was missional as Jesus came into the world. And that it may explain why virtually every well-functioning church plant that I've seen that manages to become self-supporting and reproducing tends to be more focused on the second person of the Trinity. I have yet to see a church plant that does not have, that is not Trinitarian, but does not have its primary focus on the second person of the Trinity. This Jesus thing is important. But then you probably already think that, being Anglicans. Okay. maybe 50 years ago. Do any of you remember Christendom? I have vague memories. In fact, I had a flashback a couple of years ago. It was a Remembrance Day service, and I get called out to be the padre, except by the politicians who make a point of calling me madre to show that they know, right? And, you know, the veterans are still in Christendom. And so they line you up to go on the platform and do your little whatever you do there as the padre, madre, reverend person. And we were lined up to go out, and there was the federal politician, the provincial politician, the municipal politician, and me. And the I won't even say which one, because now you know I'm from Etobicoke, you can identify them. But one of them looked around to see where the front of the line was going to be and went and shoved in front of me to be at the front. And then their correspondent in another level of government saw that. And they went, I ended up at the back. I wasn't going to fight them for the spot. But the veterans, being who they were, changed the front of the line so that I was now the front and wound around it and went up on the platform. I confessed to a moment of unholy satisfaction. So we finished our thing at the Legion, we marched down to the cenotaph, it happened again. This time, the same politician realized that the line was going to start from the other end, did a reverse, they all went over to the other side, and the Legionnaires, being Christendom, started the line with me again, and I had another moment of unholy triumph. But up until about 50 years ago, we Protestants, we had such an easy, straightforward job, relatively speaking. We were the church in the village or the church in the neighborhood who preached from the pulpit. We catechized the children. We buried the dead. We married the living. We baptized the results. That's what we did. We said grace at official functions, and we knew what to do, which was what our parents' generation did before us and what they did before them and their parents before them through the centuries. And when our people immigrated, our churches followed our people. And we would open a new church in Stoughton, Saskatchewan. Where's Stoughton? Oh, Stoughton. There's Stoughton. Okay. I know. I was there. But when we would, the United Church is still open, by the way. I just wanted to hear that. We opened a new church in Stoughton, Saskatchewan, because it was at the intersection of a railway and two highways. And those people needed a church, and those people wanted a church, and those people sacrificed to build a church. They gave up lumber from their own homes and their own barns to build it. And many of the churches in that area of Saskatchewan, incidentally, were union churches where the United and the Anglicans and the Presbyterians worked together because they wanted a church that badly. And of course, it isn't like that anymore in Stoughton, Saskatchewan. The young people moved away for jobs, and now they've come back for the oil. And the link that tied them from generation to generation to generation isn't only cracked like it was a generation ago. It's gone. And it's hard to recover. And if you think that the five elderly ladies who are still at Fillmore United Church, where I was, up the road from Stoughton, by the way, can bring in the young people by inviting them to quilt with them, which is a main form of outreach. But it's not only the church that's disappearing, it's the community dances, it's the collegial nature of community that held everything together. It has disintegrated. At one time, we could count on at least extended families to influence extended families. In my own congregation, which is not a huge congregation, I now have two sets of grandparents who are raising grandchildren because their middle-class kids have pooped out. You know what I mean. And more often outside the church community, we're seeing extended families that are disintegrating, but there are no grandparents and there are no aunts and uncles who are in good enough condition themselves to take and make the sacrifices involved in raising children. And we are seeing, I think, the greatest internal collapse of social institutions that has happened, I think, more than centuries. I think it's millennia. We're seeing We're seeing respect for law and order. We're seeing school teachers suffering this lack of link with the community, that it's not just the church, it is a vast breakdown. And part of my, you know, pessimistic, Germanic, post-apocalyptic kind of disaster thinking says that when it all collapses, we're still living on the vestiges of stability that came to us from a previous generation. But what happens when elections are run by people who have no interest in voting and are too cynical to do it even if they were? Those people are going to be looking after us when we're in homes. I think, some of you are going to think this sounds really depressing, but I see it as a source of hope. I think if everything were to collapse, the community that is integral to the Church of Jesus Christ will be the foundation on which it's built again. When the Roman Empire collapsed in the 3rd century, one of the reasons that Constantine adopted, I mean, I know the story, the shield, the ankh, the cross, whatever it was, But I think one of the reasons that Christianity was adopted as the official religion of the empire is that it was the only group left in society that cared for the sick. Only grouping that looked after each other, and the stranger, and the babies. And whatever happens to our institutions, there is a sense that the community of Jesus will form and reform and reform again, and that there's always a place for us. It just may not be the place that we're accustomed to. We began to feel Christendom slipping away from us in the 1960s, I think. I still hear stories at Alderwood of when we had 1,000 children in the Sunday school. What a day that must have been. And yet it's odd that in our apex of success, we were already losing our underpinnings. And the whole thing was eroding out from under us, and we were too successful to notice what was happening. And as we did church extension, we planted more churches like ourselves. And when we, the church, are faced with a troubled future now, almost always the answers we seek are in, I don't think this is cynical, we look for our answers in restructuring. How many of you have been involved in a restructuring? If you haven't, you will be. It feels like progress to do restructuring. Sometimes it is progress, but one logical response in times of market decline is to open new franchises. At one time, the Anglican Church in Canada, it was the Starbucks of Canada. If a neighborhood was gentrifying, or if a new subdivision of a certain quality was being built, a new Anglican franchise went in. And in the United Church, we still cheer ourselves up by remembering that we have more franchises than Tim Hortons, but with free trade coffee. In Canada, we who are from historic Protestant denominations have a cultural sort of love-hate thing with American models of business and success in the church. Is that true in your, where you are? On one hand, the Harvard Business School ethos has taken us over. At one time, the minister's office was called the church study. Have any of you tried to study in your study lately? It's a wave of, in the United Church, we say we're ordained to word, sacrament, and pastoral care. Now I really think we're ordained to money, meetings, and management. Really? Do I get an amen? Thank you. I see that hand. And you know, we get a certain satisfaction about thumbing our noses at American models of success. I mean, we weren't aware until last night that there were British models of success. We have to do a little adjusting here. But I think we come to conferences, we long for this pattern, for this magic bullet that will make things work again, even if we don't aspire to success. If we only got the right rector, if only the bishop would see the light. But you don't say that. If only that presbytery would get its act together. I've been doing this for a while, and you know, I think those are the wrong questions. Thank you, George. Where are you? Thanks, George, for bringing us back to the Trinity. Thank you for reminding me that I have never heard the words one holy Catholic apostolic at a conference for church planters. And raising the question of what we are developing and reproducing and what has taken us captive. I think it says a lot that those words are new to me at a conference, and I've been to a lot of them. I want to show you a clip I picked up from a friend a couple of weeks ago that I think expresses our ambiguity through those famous theologians, the Simpsons.
What are they doing to the church?
We're rebranding it. The old church was skewing pious. We prefer a faith-based emporium teeming with impulse buy items.
I feel like I want to throw up.
Then my work is done.
Why does Jesus have a lasso?
Because he's all man.
Money changed. Get your money changed right here in the temple.
That could not be more blasphemous.
Where's Bart? Do a nice one for Grandma.
Fine.
These new pews are so comfy.
I am not going to be taken in by all of this.
Lisa, don't sulk. You're on the Jumbotron.
Adorable.
And Lord, please remember our infirm parishioners, especially Mrs. Glick, who's recovering from hip surgery. And now let us rise and,
He's not gonna say it.
Trust me, he'll say it or I'll bust him down to Thursday night vespers.
And thank Crazy Larry, whose big screen TV prices are insane. Nay, nay! And now to deliver a special sermon on the sanctity of deliciousness, the Noid.
That's it!
Quiet, Lisa. Everyone in the store is looking at you.
They should take a good look at themselves and what their church has become.
Lisa, it's still the same basic message. We've just dressed it up a little.
Like the Whore of Babylon?
That is a false analogy.
No, it's not. It's apt. Apt! Don't you see what Mr. Burns has done to this church?
He restored it from nave to narthex.
He supersized the pews for the Zaftig believers.
He put ice in the urinals.
Those are all wonderful things, but they've cost the church its soul. And I, for one, will not be a part of it.
Do you want your hand stamped so you can come back in?
No, I'm leaving this church forever.
Oh, no!
I don't know how to feel.
You should be very upset.
Got it. Oh!
How is that?
A little much.
Oh, wow.
Lord, I'm not turning my back on you. I just need to find a temple that's free of corruption.
Why do you have to be so different? Always making a big deal out of everything. Oh.
Mom, I know it's you. I can't believe you're eavesdropping on my prayers.
Honey, I'm worried about your soul. I want at least one person from this family to go to heaven.
I still believe in God. I just think there's another path to him or her.
Her? Oh, she's just kidding, Mr. Lo...
We have an overarching theology, understanding of God, life in the kingdom that guides us in church planting. There's also an element of know-how. What do you do next? And I was an expert in church planting because I studied it as part of my doctoral program. And then I planted a church and I was a lot less of an expert. And then I did it again. And I began to realize that parenting that church planting like parenting, most of the expertise happens before you have children. And there is an element of understanding, overarching theology. There's also an element of know-how. What do you do when you turn up and you're all in the parking lot and the caretaker has forgotten to open the building? What do you do when it's 4 o'clock and nobody has turned up yet? What do you do when the person you were counting on to run the soundboard just isn't there when you need? How do you find people who do not have major psychological issues to help you plant a new church? And if you've ever planted, you know that that's an important issue, right? Oh, yeah. But in the know-how issues, when we hunt for our answers in magic bullets, this is certainly where we can't go. Because there is an element of Jesus that said, what does it profit if you gain the entire world but lose your own soul? And so I have learned to be suspicious of technique-based church growth or church planting stuff. I think the best way that you can learn to do what you need to do is make contact with a mentor and let them work through the situations that you are working through as you're working through them. Because two things will happen. Whatever worked for me last year will not work for me today. It's just the reality of ministry in the 21st century. But the other is, because church planters tend to be somewhat idealistic to begin with, are prone to great hopes and great disappointments, and unless they have a stabilizing influence on their life, they will burn themselves out or take on great fits of discouragement at 4 o'clock when, if they only hung in for 5 more minutes, 20 people would show up. And I can tell you, I've started services with 3 people just being too depressed to even look up. And at the end of the singing time, they're 120. Where did they come from? And why can't they be on time? So as I say, I was an expert. I fear that I am no longer. But the other confession I wanted to make is that by a sad misfortune of birth, I'm not an Anglican. I have to say, you Anglicans, just show me your hands for a second. I'm not going to say anything insulting. Yeah, you're proud. In a good sense. You mystify me occasionally. I was at a conference a number of years ago with John Bowen, and I can't remember if it was you, John, who asked the question, if you were to take away everything superfluous from the church, everything that was not absolutely essential for you to be the church, you know, we United Church people may give up our Voices United hymn book, what would be left if everything was gone? Do you remember what the answer to that was? They said, the bishop. I thought, that has got to be the weirdest thing I've ever heard. Is it a fetish for purple shirts? But from the perspective of an outsider, there is, in fact, something in Anglicanism that I think carries the echo of a great church planting movement. It's like the way there's an array of radio telescopes somewhere down, I think, in New Mexico that have pointed to the outer reaches of the universe and pick up the echoes of the sound of the Great Bang from the beginning of the creation of the universe. Because in your Episcopal system, as I understand it, is still the echo of a great apostolic church planting movement that goes back to the early centuries of missionary bishops who left their comfort and safety and security to go into the wild and often hostile tribes of Europe with a message of the good news of the kingdom of God, and to establish networks of new churches which became the diocese, which in turn sent out apostolic bishops to other people groups to raise up networks of church planters from whom would emerge new apostolic missionary bishops. And so many of our historic churches still carry the echo. They carry the names of great apostolic church planters who were in the memories of the people, or at least the memories of the people ancestors who planted those churches, names like St. Paul and Martin. I don't get the St. Swithin in the swamp thing. Wildebrord. I mean, whenever you see an odd name on a church, it was probably a great apostolic church planter. And one thing I find encouraging among Anglicans is the vestigial memory that the primary role of church governance is not about administering assets. Even in tumultuous times, it is not about expanding the franchise or keeping up the brand name in the territory or even asserting whatever agenda happens to be on. Your roots, your structures, your history point to persons with church planting vision in primary positions of leadership. And if there must be budgets and buildings and bookstores and bureaucracies, then they exist to serve a larger purpose. And does that resonate with you at all? I think, I don't know about out there, I think for us that's really where we want to go. I wonder sometimes in my inner self if there are three elements to church planting and to church. There's the overall theology, there's the know-how of figuring out what to do next and recovering when you do it wrong so you can do it next again. But there's also an element of God empowering us and guiding us and doing in us and through us what we cannot do ourselves. I wonder sometimes if the kind of loss of Christendom that we are experiencing in what used to be mainline churches and are sometimes now called cynically sideline churches, but the historic churches, I wonder sometimes if God is allowing what is not fruitful to be cut back. I can't bear the excuse the last 30 years, well, we're just losing the deadwood. Well, we lost a lot of live wood with the deadwood. But there is a sense of natural selection that what is alive will grow and will reproduce, and what is not, you know, we're just running out of the financial resources to keep supporting what cannot live itself. And if I was czar of the universe, hope of the United Church, no, never. That's too scary. I would say, let's stop supporting what cannot self-sustain. You know, it's not a cruel Darwinian, it's a recognition that some things give life, bring life, and some things suck out life. And I've worked in the grunt work level of pastoral ministry for 30-something years. I don't have the energy to carry anything that will not walk by itself, unless it can't. I'll care for the sick, the lame, the maimed, the impoverished, but I'm not the mama robin who's going to feed those great big fat baby birds. And I want to say I resent any resources that are taken out of the congregation I'm serving to feed somebody else's big, non-thriving, fat baby birds. That's, if that didn't make any sense to you, you haven't been out there long enough. I know for many of us, our experience of leadership does not look like apostolic leadership. Many of you are offering very good leadership in situations where good leadership isn't necessarily recognized or appreciated. I was talking to someone before class, and I would say the human potential movement after the Second World War has really compromised our ability to offer leadership, at least in the United Church. After the Second World War, of course, the human potential movement saw leadership in three categories. One was directive leadership. That was like dictators. That was a bad thing, right? Then there was laissez-faire leadership, which was you leave them alone and let them go home, wagging their tails behind them, and what happens, what happens. And then the good kind of leadership was considered enabling leadership, where we enable others to function. And the problem is, in reality, the business world gave this up, I think, in the late 60s, only about 15% of the population can function in terms of enabling leadership. Most of them are middle children because they're used to working with somebody bigger and meaner and littler and cuter. So what we've done, at least in our church culture, is we've stuck ourselves in a mode where the acceptable kind of leadership is out of the range of giftings and ability of the majority of our people. And if you're supposed to act enabling but are in fact directive, the only way you can exercise leadership is by being sneaky and manipulative from behind and pretending not to be doing what you're doing, or to do laissez-faire and just let things go wherever they're going to go. And I think, at least, I don't know about you Anglicans, but in my denominational culture, I believe that that understanding of leadership has paralyzed not only us, but a great many institutions in our culture. And so I just want to show you a little clip that says everything to me about what leadership feels like in churches in the early years of the 21st century.
Cat herder in our family.
Herding cats. Don't let anybody tell you it's easy.
Anybody can herd cattle. Holding together 10,000 half-wild short hairs, well, that's another thing altogether.
Being a cat herder is probably about the toughest thing I think I've ever done.
I got this one this morning, right here. And if you look at his face, it's just ripped to shreds, you know?
You see the movies, you hear the stories, I'm living a dream. Not everyone can do what we do.
I wouldn't do nothing else.
It ain't an easy job, but when you bring a herd into town and you ain't lost a one of them, ain't a feeling like it in the world.
EDS, managing the complexities of the digital economy.
That resonates. Someone told me that Southern Baptists were the world's premier church planters because they fought among themselves like alley cats. You put them in a room together, close the doors, there would be yowling, scratching, bodies thrown against the wall, but the net results would always be more little alley cats. Honestly, I think our churches would do better if we saw every conflict opportunity as an opportunity for church planting and supported it. I'm a pragmatist. It is ironic, or perhaps God-inspired, that we live in an era when Christendom, as we know it, is coming to a close, and this great church planting movement is spontaneously erupting all over the globe. We heard last night how two churches a week that are known to be planted every week in Britain. I was in the Dominican Republic last week doing sand ministry. The official statistic is that 8% of the population is some kind of non-Roman Catholic Protestant, but in, I guess most Protestants are non-Roman Catholic. But in every little village, there were crumbled buildings with freshly painted signs that said things like, pardon, I don't, my Spanish is not good, and so I don't have the memory of the grammar, but Ecclesia Evangelistica, or Pentecost, or Apostolica, or, and every little village has freshly painted signs that are designating what I believe are new church locations. The taxi drivers, I mean, you pray in those taxis, I'll tell you. But I took a three-hour taxi drive, and the taxi driver was playing what I recognize as vineyard music in Spanish, and some kind of Christian rap that had the words Jesus Domine repeated again and again. And I'll tell you a little bit tomorrow about the invisible church plants that are erupting around us in the GTA, and this is not an excuse for triumphalism. We're a long ways from that temptation. But it reminds, it points to the vitality of the universal church, which is rooted and grounded on Jesus Christ. The life of the kingdom of God is erupting in expressions of churches, whether they are officially sanctioned or not. In other words, the good news is it doesn't all depend on us. The bad news is, it's going to go on without us, whether or not we get our act together. But personally, I would rather be part of the work of the kingdom. Jesus said that if, when it reminds me of Jesus on the road to Jerusalem and his supporters are shouting praise to the Son of David and blocking traffic, and some local official tells him to tell his followers to shut up and get off the road. And Jesus said, if they were silent, the rocks themselves would have to shout because the kingdom of God is not containable and controllable. And what we're seeing within an hour's drive north of here and east and west, where from where we are standing, that we're Anglican and United and Presbyterian churches are closing, Caribbean and mainland Chinese and Hong Kong and West African missionaries are opening storefronts and living rooms and industrial properties and coffee shops all around us. And they, if they are not historically descended from the great missionary bishops of Europe, that same genetic pattern has erupted spontaneously of church planting, apostolic missionaries raising up networks of church plants and church planters, and that looks very much like bishops in a diocese. Go figure. As George said yesterday, if you get the DNA right, the diversity that comes out of that can be trusted. Because God as Trinity is a force of life that is behind all life. He's the force of love that is behind all love. The source of church that is behind all true church. The very God of very God who makes us human in community. And in the end, despite our best efforts to contain it, where God is, faith will always break out of religious institutions, and the living church of Jesus Christ will emerge from the best efforts of organized religion, and it even emerges from disorganized religion, which those of you who have planted church will understand. If we aspire to anything less, we're just an alliance of small business operators who are fighting over turf and market share, trying to open new franchises to take in enough money to pay salaries at head office. And if we aspire to anything less, church planting becomes a narcissistic attempt to clone ourselves or to grow babies for body parts to keep their sickly older siblings going. In my tradition, in order to plant a church, we require years of committee meetings involving dozens of people. If we were to include the cost of paid staff hours, subsidization, salaries, equipment, rentals, capital costs, it probably costs us in the millions to craft a new church that sometimes will have difficulty weaning itself from the public purse. And you know, we can't afford to have any more babies like that. Interesting, I mentioned a parallel movement is the franchise fertility clinics. And if that was the only way to make babies, what a dreary world it would be. And frankly, why anyone would choose to make babies that way when there are alternatives is completely baffling. I just want to close in saying church planting isn't really our agenda. It's God's agenda. Church planting isn't done by our smarts, but our availability. Church planting isn't done by our great skills, but by our great persistence. Church planting isn't done because we have all the answers, but because we have lots more love than we can contain in our communities of faith. Church planting is done when we love what is out there as much as God loved what is down here. Church planting happens when we stop controlling the processes and defining how it must happen and who can do it and where they should have been trained and what their salary must be and where they can locate. I'm not really an anarchist. But, you know, anarchists plant a lot more churches. So, again, in closing, I just want to say that if we have the DNA, why can't we trust? Let's pray. Our God, we live in a puzzling and perplexing time to be the church, and yet you have seen the church through more puzzling and perplexing times. We know that you are here. We know that you love us and the world which surrounds us. We know that as we offer ourselves, you will provide everything that is needed for the journey if we'll simply drop our own luggage and follow you. Amen. Well, the fourth is probably operating with integrity in who we really are. And in terms of church planting, different styles of leadership work at different times. If you are what we call a catalytic church planter, that is, you go out from scratch and find your launch team and do your gathering of a first community. And by the way, we don't form core groups in church planting. We form a launch team, and then we disband the launch team at the first service because all you need are charter members thinking they own the joint. So for the initial stages, often you want a person who is quite directive in their leadership style. Says, you, do this. You, rent this. The trouble is, as soon as you launch your first service, that kind of leadership style is counterproductive to building teams. And so you need a more collaborative style of leadership that is able to build ownership in other people. And once you put up the building and possibly burnt out the church planting team, then you will usually find another kind of leadership who knows how to raise money to pave the parking lot. But I cannot overemphasize this, that God uses who we are as we are. And I believe that we are facing artificial restrictions within our structures that says it has to be done that way. We're sticking square pegs in round holes. I believe that our screening process for ministry, at least in the United Church, we screen out a lot of our church planters because they're not good and patient at jumping through hoops. Yeah. That's a very good question. Can the catalytic person and the person who pays the parking lot be the same person? Yes, actually they can. The trouble is the transition gifts are very, very different. And when you talk to someone who planted a church and it grew to 1,000, very often they're one of the very rare beasts who can make that transition from one leadership style to the other. Sometimes a catalytic church planter can go into a completely different situation and be team building. It's just that you're changing your relationship dramatically with the people you're working with. And that's where a wise bishop or mentor is able to say, great job, take a break, a sabbatical, or let's put you in another situation where you can re-energize and go out and do it again when you're ready. That's a good question. Yeah. So how can you tell there are the right conditions versus just stepping out in faith and doing it? If I knew that, I would have fewer scars. I do believe that for a person who is a church planter, and this is where supervision comes in handy, it is extremely important that the activist personality learn how to do spiritual practices. You know, Willow Creek has just discovered that the seeker-sensitive gathering people thing isn't working for making disciples of Jesus. And so they're returning to spiritual practices. So for a church planter, it becomes absolutely imperative the ability to listen to God and not get carried away by one's own enthusiasm or vision and drive. So myself, I would say, if in doubt, fly a couple of, throw out a couple of lines and see what bites on them. I have no qualms at all about killing a project that's not working. And I think we have to be willing to do that. Say, tried, that's great, that was a great attempt, thank God you tried that, let's kill it and try something else. We have to be willing to do that. Yeah. I would. I think we need to develop a culture where we have permission to fail and where a person who has had no failures in the last 6 months is admonished for not trying. Really, we are in rapidly changing times. If you know exactly what to do next, you are either all-knowing, omniscient, omnipresent, omnipotent. Do any more omnis from you Anglicans? God has that job description. The rest of us, a good church planter will be able to read the world around them, but you're only as successful as often as you're successful reading your children's minds and doing the right thing all the time. Even if you're right, you don't always know it, and when you're wrong, you don't always know it. And it just teaches you to be humble and to walk closely with your God. Is that helpful? Yeah. That's an interesting observation, John. I'll let you finish it if you really want to. Conventional wisdom 15 years ago would say, well, if you're going to church plant and reach young people, you need two guitars and a bass and a drum and a certain style of music and a certain style of preaching. And it's simply not true. One of the most rapidly growing church planting movements in North America is the Greek Orthodox. You ever attended a Greek Orthodox service? I just don't get it. I just don't get it. They come in and out and go for lunch and a cigarette, and then they come back. And so we're seeing several parallel things happening. There is a church planting movement among young people, which is highly liturgical. Smells and bells. And in our church, we hired an organist. And the people in their 20s and 30s love the big basso profundo organ, you know, that makes my glasses vibrate on my face, because it's an emotion-based, it's an experiential instrument, actually. If it's, you know, the little squeezy Hammond organ played with foot pedals, that doesn't quite do it, but I've been there too. So the answer is no, there is no such thing as a generic church plant. The thing that we need to watch is that there is a generation of church plants which are church for the unchurched, but which are in fact church for the children of evangelicals. And that's not a criticism. It's just sometimes we set out to do one thing really well and we end up doing something else really well. And they are doing it really well, but we still haven't found enough ways of planting churches that lets us get into the places where they are now 3 generations or 15 generations removed from Christian memory. And that's where biodiversity comes in. We need to be prepared to launch a huge multiplicity of churches and be prepared to let 90% of them fail, provided we support the church planters in that process. We don't know what works. Why does God create dandelions where 1,500 seeds go out and 3 of them take root and grow? That's so wasteful. Well, maybe it is the way of the kingdom of God that the sower goes out to sow and scatters seed indiscriminately, and some of those things are going to grow. And so, no, I don't think there is such a thing anymore as the right kind of generic church plant, but I know that people who attend church planting seminars and associate with each other tend to plant similar-looking churches. That's not wrong. It's just not adequate diversity. Yeah. Yeah, I've often wondered if our presbytery would benefit from a department of euthanasia or arson, but you didn't hear that from me. I think I may not be a good church planter on this count because I have some pastoral instinct. I have reservations about axing the 5 old ladies who've kept the church going forever and ever. But I do think as judiciaries, we must insist that they make room for a new church plant. And I think if that is done pastorally and sensitively, many, many churches will make space in their building, even if they can't make space in their relationships and in their heart. An ideal situation is to have an existing church adopt a new congregation. And I know there are so many dollars wrapped up in our real estate. Again, if I was czar of the universe, I would never sell an urban church building. I would much rather give it to another active group, church planting group who isn't of our denomination, than to let it just go into the pot and pay salaries for another 10 years. What a waste when we give up prime urban property because we don't think that it should go to the Church of God, of holiness, of 12 apostles and the Lion of Judah. You know, one of those churches where the name wraps around the bus 3 times? Because they're not our kind of people. Well, you know what? They may be God's kind of people, and our ancestors who sacrificed themselves for that property so that the community around them could know Christ. Maybe it's a vision worth upholding. But as I say, nobody lets me on property committees that make those decisions. Anything else? Okay. You know, the Simpsons are brilliant theologically. And no, they are brilliant theologically. I'm sorry, that's all I have, but if you pick up something else, would you send it to me? You know, my internal pirate just hates using series. I would much rather, oh, never mind. This is on tape. I know there are. As soon as they're not bootleg, though, I just don't feel they have the same value.